I have a new definition of the generation gap for you. It's not only that you need the microphones a little bit higher, but the difference in which the Megillah is presented. About 9:30, the youngsters of the school were here, and the young people who read to us the Megillah read it then, except the rabbi then was all dressed up in a black suit with a Haman's beard, you know. After all, rabbis have to be the villains in peace. And every time Haman's name was read, there were 500 Gregors sounding out to drown out his name. And there you were, sitting so quietly as adults. We are celebrating Purim today according to the Christian calendar. And I put it this way because Purim doesn't come for another 10 days. But since all of our children will be out of school when Purim comes, we wanted them to have a chance to celebrate it, we decided that we would celebrate Purim while they were still here. And since our calendar doesn't unfortunately determine the public school calendars, we would forgive the public schools their calendar and we would simply accommodate to it. And reading the Megillah suggested to me the way in which I'd like to begin this morning. And that is to talk about writing, reading, ancient writing, modern writing. I don't know how it is with you, but when it comes to thinking and writing, I'm something of a troglodyte. I use a 79-cent ballpoint pen, or a number two graphite pencil and paper. I find that I'm one of those people who can't do two things at once. And that is, I can't think and hunt and peck for the right letters on the typewriter. I admire those who can. And when it comes to the modern miracles, like a word processor, I am absolutely bedazzled by anybody who can manage them. I recognize all the advantages that our machinery produces for us, but I'm tongue-tied. I'm reduced, I'm afraid, to recognizing that in many ways I'm a member of a pre-industrial society, or at least conditioned by it. And when I began to think whether or not my reading and writing habits were, since they're so primitive, very much like those of our ancestors, I had to recognize that in some ways they were and in many ways they weren't. I write longhand, but I have the advantage of a secretary, thank God, who can translate my scrawl into type, and then someone can take the type and in a matter of minutes print up hundreds or thousands of copies. In the ancient world, in the world of our biblical ancestors, every single manuscript had to be patiently and laboriously written out by hand, which meant not only that there were many fewer books and manuscripts in circulation, but that the standardization of texts was immensely difficult, because inevitably when you copy anything, you make mistakes, you change words, you omit a word or two or even a sentence or two. And so one of the problems which has come to us, any of us who do scholarly research, is that even if a text seems to be of its time, authentic, it may not represent the intentions of the author because it may have passed through one or two or five scribal hands and have a compounding of errors in the process. But there's another way in which my writing differs from that of our ancestors. And that is, I write within the framework of well-accepted rules. I have on my desk a dictionary. The dictionary tells me how words are spelt and how there is general agreement about the words and how they are spelt. I have books which deal with the rules of grammar and of punctuation. We were all taught these in school. And so when we write, we have a fair degree of certainty that others will read what we write pretty much as we intended them to read it. Now, in the ancient world, in the biblical world, there were as yet no accepted rules of grammar, of punctuation, or of spelling. Writing hadn't developed that degree of refinement. Moreover, the writing, since it was difficult, laborious, it was expensive. And not only was it difficult and expensive to hire a scribe to copy out the book that you wanted, but the papyrus or the parchment were expensive things to use to write on. And so it was a very costly enterprise. And compression was originally the order of the day. If you pick up a very early text from the ancient Middle East, you'll find that there's no separation between words or sentences or paragraphs. As much as crammed into, compressed into a given space as can possibly be done. And obviously when letters simply run on, and there's no general agreement on how they're to be spelt, and there's no punctuation whatsoever, reading becomes something of a guesswork game, an art. And one can, in all good conscience, read a particular phrase or a piece of paper in any number of different ways. And this leads to the fact that our ancestors read quite differently than we do. There were in their libraries no signs which commanded silence, because no one read silently the way we do. We have fair confidence that when we train our children to recognize syllables and words, they'll immediately be able to translate those syllables and words into meaning. And we discourage children from taking what's on the paper, sounding it out before it passes into their minds, because that slows them down. There's so much that needs to be accomplished when it comes to reading. But the ancients had to teach reading orally. That is to say, a teacher could not be confident he could put a text in front of the student, and the student would automatically be able to read the text the way the teacher knew it should be read, without punctuation, without conventions of grammar, and most of all, because of the nature of the alphabet. If you look at they took it with them. I'd hope they'd left me my audio-visual exhibit of the morning. But if you look at the Megillah, or you look at a Torah scroll, you'll see that there are no vowels. There are none of the little dots that tell us whether B is to be read B, Ba, Be, Bo, or Boo. And the original alphabet of the ancient world has no vowels in it. It is a consonantal alphabet entirely. And so even if you can form, you recognize where the word begins and ends, you can read that word in any number of different ways. So instruction in the ancient world began with the teacher reading a text to the student, making sure that the student could read the text back to the teacher, so the teacher would hear that the student had read it correctly, and going back and forth until the teacher was sure that the child had this particular classic text in mind. And so everyone was taught to read out loud, and as late as the 5th, 6th century of our era, St. Augustine mentions in his autobiography how surprised he was when he went to Rome and found in one of the schoolers there, one of the senior scholars sitting in a corner reading the way we read, silently, just reading the text without reading it aloud. We often, when I was growing up, talked about the Chinese schoolroom. And by a Chinese schoolroom, we meant a place where everybody was reading aloud. Well, all ancient classrooms were Chinese schoolrooms, filled with babble, filled with sound, as children read. There was no such thing as reading something silently. Now, because of the difficulties involved in reading, because of the needs of compression, because of the lack of agreement as to text, almost all the ancient texts are different from ours in one major respect, and that has to do with brevity. The ancient rule was multo in parva, much in little. Say as much as you can in as few words as you can, because if you use too many words, nobody's going to copy them out. Nobody's going to take the time. I have a friend, you've met him, Martin Gilbert. He's been one of our first Friday speakers. Among his other accomplishments, he's the official biographer of Winston Churchill. And he has already completed 8 volumes of that official biography. Each volume runs to 500 pages or more. It's a magnificent piece of work, but it's the kind of work which no author in antiquity would dare to undertake. Who would pay to have such a book copied? Some patron would have to want that book so desperately that he would hire a scribe and have to pay a living wage for the scribe, which would support the scribe and his family for 3, 4, maybe 5 years, in order to get a single copy of that text. And so the ancient texts deal with compression. They avoid many of the things which we take for granted. If you read the biblical literature, there is almost no description of place. There's no description of physical presence, the look of a character. There's no attempt to explain motivation. What you have is incident, and you are left to try and decipher, decode yourself, the motivations which led the actors to do what they did do. We're not told, for instance, why Adam gave in to Eve and ate of the forbidden fruits. It's left up to us to decide whether she cajoled him into eating of the fruit, whether he wanted to in the first place and was looking for an excuse, what the reason might have been. We're not told why Abraham was willing to attempt to obey God and sacrifice his son Isaac simply on God's command. We're not told why Moses decided suddenly one day to strike down an Egyptian taskmaster. It's left to our imagination as we read the story. And because we come to these biblical stories at various periods in our lives, we're thinking about different ideas, we're concerned, and our anxieties and our hopes are different. We tend to read the biblical stories in a variety of ways differently each time we come to them. And that's part of the miracle of the continuing popularity of the biblical material. When you explain everything, once you've read the book, you put it down, you'll never pick it up again. And if a novelist has in 1,000 pages told us everything he wants us ever to know about the characters in his novel, we may read it completely, but we'll never look at it again. We've gotten as much out of that book as we possibly can. But you can read the biblical stories again and again and again and read them differently each time you come to them. Shakespeare, you recall, said that brevity is the soul of wit. In a real sense, brevity is that which introduces into a well-shaped and structured text surprise, mystery, the things which are compelling, which draw us back to that text time and time again. Now, all this is by way of introducing some of the joys, the unexpected joys of the Megillah. The Megillah of Esther is one of the last of the books of the Bible. It's probably written sometime around the 2nd century before the Common Era. By biblical standards, it's prolix. It's verbose. That is, it contains 165 sentences. Now imagine a whole novel being written in 165 sentences. And imagine that the judgment made on that novel is that, in fact, you could cut it down a bit. It includes, you know, the heavy language of a number of the statements put out by the Persian bureaucracy. But still, it is at one with the rest of the biblical literature in that it presents us the incident without description or without explanation of motivation. The story begins, as we heard it read to us today, with the reading, with the enjoyment of the, or endurance perhaps, of this long, long, expensive banquet organized by the Achaemenid Persian king Ahasuerus for his nobles. It's a banquet that lasted 180 days and 180 nights. I'd be tired after the first week. And I suspect it was only the fact that the king's command was arbitrary that kept most of the nobles at the table. But be that as it may, we have a description of we have simply the statement there was this long banquet, this lavish banquet. We're not told why the king suddenly decided in the 3rd year of his reign to hold this banquet, but he did. And we are told that at some point in this orgy, he ordered his queen Vashti to appear, to put on her royal diadem that the people and the nobles might approve of her beauty. And the first question of motivation, which fascinates us, is why did Vashti refuse to obey the king's order? We're back in times where the king's whim is his command, and anyone who fails to obey the king's command will be summarily executed. Why should Vashti have disobeyed her liege lord? Now, one is obviously suspecting of the feeling that the author simply had to find a way to depose one queen so another queen could come to the throne. But of course, if we read the story of Vashti in modern terms, in terms of the women's movement, we read into her actions one of the first historic protests against a woman being treated as a sexual object. She's not simply going to allow herself to be paraded before a group of men, that which she would find it degrading to have that done. Therefore, she refuses the command. And women's magazines are filled with interpretations of Purim of this kind. Indeed, Purim is, for the Jewish women's movement, the favorite holiday of them all. They have a hero. Notice I didn't say heroine. But it's interesting when one looks back at the commentaries written on this story by those who lived in the Oriental world, much closer to Vashti's world and time, that they don't read the story quite this way. They remind us that Vashti was noble-born, unlike Esther, and self-proud. And they postulate that the reason that she refused the king's command was not that she was unused to his calling her to appear before his lords, but the Bible says that he ordered her to appear before the peoples and the lords, and that for a noble-born woman to display herself before the hoi polloi, before the lower classes, was an act which would have been seen demeaning, that she acted out of pride, in other words, rather than out of gender principle. And this suggestion seems to carry some sense of weight to it, because and it suggests that the king's command itself, which includes the word to appear before the populace and the nobles, may have been deliberately demeaning, that he had something else in mind besides displaying her beauty. But be that as it may, Vashti is deposed. There's room now for Esther on the throne. And we get to the question of motive, which most concerned, disturbed the more pious of our ancestors. How could a nice Jewish girl enter a beauty contest? That's not the kind of thing that nice Jewish girls do. Moreover, how could a nice Jewish girl enter a beauty contest whose prize was to marry a pagan? A non-Jew. Now, when they faced this problem, their usual explanation was to excuse Esther on the basis of immaturity. Esther, after all, could not have been more than 11 or 12. And that's true. In the Oriental world, the women who were brought into the harems of the potentates were youngsters, 11, 12, at very most 13. And there was a great premium placed upon those who thought in these terms on extreme youth. I won't go into the Freudian basis of all of that, but accept it as a statement of historic fact. Now, obviously, a little girl of 11 or 12 is not equipped to make the kind of serious judgment which would say this is not the kind of thing that a nice Jewish girl should or should not do. So then the onus falls on Mordecai. We have a different problem. Mordecai is an adult. He's a courtier. He's her uncle. He's her guardian. He ought to know better. Not only does Mordecai know that the prize of this contest is marriage to this pagan king, but he knows that even if Esther is refused, she must stay in the palace for a half a year. And he certainly knows that the palace kitchens don't prepare kosher food. And he certainly knows that there isn't a minyan in the palace so that Esther can, on the Shabbos, daven, and so that on the holiday she can attend public worship. So why should Mordecai, this good Jew, have acted in the way that he did? Now, their problem was that anything that made it into the Bible tended to become well-known, obviously, and that people modeled themselves after the behavior of biblical heroes. So what if one begins to model oneself after Mordecai? You know, what does that mean that fathers will do in terms of their daughters? So a story emerges, which you can find in the Talmudic Midrash. And that story tells us that Mordecai did not, in point of fact, decide that Esther should enter the beauty contest. Quite the opposite. He knew that she had a beauty which was already well known. He was afraid that the secret police of the Persian king would hear about her beauty, and when the order went out to bring in the most beautiful maidens of all the kingdom, she would be caught in that net. And so he hid Esther, and he tried to have her escape from the security police, but they were very efficient, and they found her out. And it was not Mordecai's decision which sent Esther into the palace, but simply that she was force-marched there by the police of the Persian Empire. Now, on what does one base this particular invention? Well, one bases it on the fact that there's no explicit statement in the Megillah that Mordecai enrolled Esther in the contest. He filled out the registration form. The text talks about Mordecai and Esther, and then says simply, and Esther was taken into the palace. And they read the verb was taken as meaning was taken by force into the palace. Then there's another pious explanation in the Talmudic Midrash. It begins with the question, on whose authority could Mordecai have proclaimed Purim to be an annual religious observance? With the exception of Hanukkah, all our other holidays are ordered to us in the Torah by God through the agent of the prophet Moses. And it's assumed that the establishment of holidays require someone who has the authority of the prophet. So Mordecai becomes a prophet. And obviously a prophet can foretell. And obviously then one can create the story that Mordecai was able to foresee that Esther would be the agent of Israel's redemption. And then far from disobeying anything that God would have disapproved of, he is obeying God's will by seeing that she gets to this place from which her whole people will be saved. The question which interests me most about motivation when it comes to the Megillah is the motivation of Haman. Haman does not appear until nearly a quarter of the story of the book of the Megillah has already been told. And suddenly we're told that the king appoints Haman to be second in command in the empire, the vizier. We're not told why he merited this appointment, but simply that Haman, the son of Hammedata, the Agagite, is appointed as the chief officer of the kingdom, that the king orders that all courtiers are to bow to him as a mark of his office, a mark of respect, that Mordecai refused to do so, and that Haman became angry and determined to destroy Mordecai and all of his people. Now, one of the questions, of course, is why should Mordecai have refused to bow to Haman? Interesting question, because there's nothing in the law which says that we may not show, as a mark of respect, our respect to those who have authority. And the answer, of course, is to invent another story. And the story is that Haman carried around his neck a golden chain from which hung an idol, and that Mordecai simply refused to perform any act which might seem as though it was avodah zarah, as though it was an act of idolatry, of bowing before some foreign god. But the more interesting question to me, and the question which is rarely seen by us, which testifies to a peculiar way in which we've been conditioned, is why this act by a single courtier, Mordecai's unwillingness to bow the knee to Haman, should have led to Haman's decision to commit genocide, to destroy the whole Jewish people. Now, it says something about our conditioning that this question is rarely looked at. We simply assume that if one attacks one Jew, somehow all Jews are suspect. For 2,000 years in the Christian world, in the Muslim world, if a Jew ran afoul of the law, the whole community might be exiled. The whole community was endangered. And we take this idea of the community of Israel being one as to destiny for granted. We know that we play a peculiar role in the theology of the peoples of the West. And so when they attack a Jew, they tend immediately to think of the sins, presumed or otherwise, of all Jews. But I remind you that the book of Esther is set in the Persian Empire, that is in the 6th, 5th century before the Common Era, 500 years and more before Jews came to be play a symbolic role in the theologies and the thought systems of the West. In the Persian Empire, there were any number, hundreds, literally, of ethnic communities, of nations, who were scattered about here and there. And there was nothing in the Zoroastrian tradition, the authoritative tradition of the Persian Empire, there was nothing in the culture of the Persian world which would have led people to think instinctively that if Mordecai is a Jew, somehow all Jews are to be made to suffer. Why then this sudden decision that all must somehow pay the price? The rabbis seized upon the phrase in which this decision is detailed in the 3rd chapter of the Megillah. Vayivuz be'enav. And it was a matter of distress in the eyes of Haman that Mordecai would not bow down to him. Therefore, he determined to destroy all his people. We often use the phrase, power corrupts. One of the ways in which power corrupts is that we feel having power, we need to assert it. And what the rabbis of the early times suggested is that it was distressful, shameful in Haman's eyes simply to avenge himself on the single human being. Why? Because obviously the second in command of the king who had the king's seal could arbitrarily imprison anyone he wanted to and execute him. That there was no way of proving power. But in order to show the magnificence of the power that he now enjoyed, he had to perform some great act. And indifferent to the human cost of that act, he determined quickly out of anger that he would avenge himself through and prove his power by attacking the whole people by genocide. And so what we have, I think, is an exhibition of one of the peculiar vices to which all of us are prone if we are fortunate enough or unfortunate enough to enjoy power. And that is that we need to display, teacher to students, employer to employee, political figure to those who come for favors or out of need. We need to display our power, and we are often tempted to do so without thought to the cost to others of the anger or the arbitrariness of our decisions. The Megillah story is not a story to be thought of in terms that are familiar to us, as another evidence of the power of anti-Semitism in the Western world. The Persian world did not know what it meant to be anti-Semitic. The myths of deicide, the myths of the pariah people, the attempt to create new religions out of our religion, none of this had yet come into being. The story is best understood, and certainly the motivations of Haman are best understood as examples of human frailty, of human failing, of the fact that all of us are tempted to use power arbitrarily, if we have it, and that we, when we use power, power always claims its victims. Amen.